Hi everyone, Drew Perrode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. In today's episode, we have Dr. Tina Bryson here to talk to us about the power of showing up and the four different types of attachment styles and how they each can shape our kids' brains in a different way. It's a fascinating conversation, whether you have kids or whether you don't, stay tuned. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep into the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, functional medicine, and mindset. I'm your host, Drew Perrode, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and most importantly, live more. My guest is two-time New York Times bestselling author, Dr. Tina Bryson. Dr. Bryson is the founder and executive director of the Center for Connection, a multidisciplinary clinical practice devoted to the study, research, and practice of play therapy. She's a licensed clinical social worker providing pediatric and adolescent psychotherapy and parenting consultations. She's the co-author with Dr. Dan Siegel, a former guest on our podcast,
awesome,
of the Yes Brain and the New York Times bestsellers, The Whole Brain Child and No Drama Discipline. Their next book, The Power of Showing Up, How Parental Presence Shapes Who Our Kids Become and How Their Brains Get Wired, comes out January 2020. Tina, welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I can't wait to talk to you, and I love your work, and I can't wait to dig in.
It's an honor to have you here. So we're going to just jump right into it. So you say that what's one thing that a parent can do to make the most difference in the long run for their child? And that's showing up.
Yeah.
What is showing up?
What's so interesting is that we have decades and decades and decades of research that show that there really is one thing that is one of the best predictors for how well kids turn out on everything we measure them on. I mean, this is social skills, this is mental health, this is academic success. I mean, really sort of all the areas we really want our kids to do well. And what they found was that that one thing was that the child has what's called secure attachment with their parent. And when Dan and I like to kind of get into this and talk about what is secure attachment at its essence, it really is the idea of a parent showing up for a kid. Now, we break that down even more and talk about how that looks like the four S's, which is safe, seen, soothed. And if you have enough of those three kinds of experiences repeatedly, you have the fourth S, which is secure, which is basically where you have enough experiences, not perfect, but enough predictable times of feeling safe, seen, and soothed, which we can talk a little bit more about. And then if you have those repeated experiences, your brain actually wires to securely know and expect that if you have a need, someone will see it and show up for you.
What's beautiful for this conversation and is that this is not just relevant to kids.
No.
This all is applicable to all aspects of our life, including how we were parented and the lasting of impact of that.
Absolutely. And how we were parented, as well as other kinds of friendships we've had, other kinds of romantic relationships
other we've influences
had.
In our life.
Absolutely.
Teachers, grandparents, coaches, etc.
Absolutely. And really, the sort of scaffolding or the framework our brain has to make sort of its best guesses or predictions about how people are going to respond to us and what to expect in relationships comes from primarily our repeated experiences with who our primary caregivers were. So sometimes that's parents, sometimes it is other adults in our lives, but really the collective experience of many relationships, because the brain is an association machine. And so what happens is these repeated experiences we have create sort of this mental model or this framework that our brain uses to make decisions, but also what can I expect in relationships? Can I expect that if I have a need, someone will notice it and show up for me? Or have I learned from my repeated experiences relationally that people aren't going to be there for me? Or that my feelings and my needs are going to be ignored, or the people I trust are actually going to do me harm. So depending on the kinds of collective experiences we have from many relationships, the brain wires those expectations and those memories, and it becomes a huge part of who we are.
What's the opposite of showing up? You already said if my needs are ignored.
Yeah.
A lot of people say, I had a pretty okay childhood,
yeah.
Nothing crazy that happened.
Yeah.
Although we do know that now, especially in the conversation of, modern day and age, more people are coming to the forefront saying, actually, I was, you know, physically abused, or I did have sexual abuse in the past. We know that one out of every four women, I'll have to double check on the stats.
That's right.
It's very high, have had an incident of sexual abuse in the past. It's there. But for somebody that's out there that's listening and says, I've had a normal, you know, childhood. I think my parents showed up. What's the opposite of showing up?
So the opposite of showing up, and we're going to use showing up as sort of a synonym for secure attachment. So about 40% of kids do not have secure attachment with their parents. They may have secure attachment with someone else, a grandparent, a coach, you know, something like that. But the other, so secure attachment is where you feel safe, seen, soothed, and over time secure. And the other side of that is what's called insecure attachment. And there are actually different kinds of categories that would fit into that. One is called an anxious ambivalent attachment. In adulthood, that's called avoidant attachment. And that's kind of a pattern where you grew up in an emotional desert. You didn't have parents who saw your needs or responded to them in sensitive and timely ways. You were kind of you grew up in a house where maybe there was a lot of attention paid to surface level things. But if you had emotions or needs, you were sort of ignored. Those were not tended to. And that's called the avoidant style of attachment. The other insecure style that we can talk about is called preoccupied attachment. In infancy and childhood, it would be called anxious ambivalent attachment. So in the first scenario I just talked about, what we see is that when we have that patterning of attachment across our childhood and into our adulthood, and we don't do anything to change it, we can stay in that place where we avoid emotion, we avoid intimacy, we sort of run away from that kind of stuff. In the preoccupied style, we grew up in a family where our parent was really inconsistent. Sometimes they saw and responded to our needs, but other times they didn't, and they were really unpredictable. We couldn't count on them. They wouldn't show up consistently for us. And so what can happen then is, instead of being free to kind of reflect on our past and make sense of it, we become preoccupied with emotions and preoccupied with intimacy and preoccupied with relationships, so much so that there's a lot of anxiety and ambivalence where you're like, oh, I want to trust you and I want you to be there for me. But people are like, wow, you're kind of intense. And so people kind of back off and they're like, see, I knew I couldn't count on people
because your
to be
mind
there.
Is wired to feel like you're never going to get That's it again. Right. So let me just jump into it.
That's right. And we see this, you know, these attachment patterns have already kind of been wired by 12 months of age. So there's a kind of gold standard experiment called the Strange Situation. It's done on 12 to 18
right.
month olds.
Which was started in the 1960s, and you talk about it inside of your book. And so I would love for you to explain what were those experiments like and what did they learn out of it?
Yeah, and it really helps reflect these different patterns of attachment. So what the Strange Situation did was, it was a laboratory situation. So a parent would bring their 12 to 18 month old infant into the lab. There'd be some toys in the room. At some point, a stranger would come in, like a researcher, and try to interact with the baby. And at some point, the parent is given the cue to get up and leave the room. So the parent leaves the baby in a strange room, some of the time by itself and some of the time with this stranger in the room. And we watch what the baby does. And we watch the second part, which is the reunion behavior. What happens when the parent comes back in? So what happens in the in these strange situations that's so interesting is that it reveals how by 12 months of age, these babies have already learned a strategy to get the best from their caregiver. So
a coping mechanism.
Absolutely. I mean, they're just brilliant already by 12 months, right? So if you have a parent who doesn't tend to your emotional needs and who kind of ignores if you have emotions that need tending to, or doesn't give you kind of sensitive, responsive, timely care, what happens is those babies don't usually cry. And they just play with the toys and they act like they don't care. But the physiology research shows these babies have heightened heart rate. Their galvanic skin response is showing a stress
they're
response.
They're acting like they don't care, but their body's saying, I very much care.
Right. But they've already learned, I'm not going to show need or big feelings or ask for anything from this caregiver because I will get a better response from this caregiver if I don't. So I'm going to, it's called avoidant attachment. I'm going to avoid attachment.
You know, I just want to pause there for a second because for anybody who's listening, you can think right now, even though we're talking about this experiment that was done and all this research, is just think about this in your own life right
totally.
Now. Where are you running this pattern? If you, can you identify with that pattern or one of the other ones that are there?
Right.
And I'm just going to take a small pause to share this question that you ask inside the book. And you say, How much have you reflected on the ways that your childhood experiences influenced your own development, thus predicting and influencing the ways you interact with your child, your children? So even if somebody doesn't have children, I don't have kids right now, right. I'm listening with like a second ear, which is, where can I relate to these? Do I have any, can I identify with any of these things? And have these been coping mechanisms that I've taken into my adulthood because of my experiences, you know, being raised?
And we often have multiple caregivers. So we might identify features of several of these. You know, I had a parent, I had one parent who gave me really great secure attachment, and we can talk about what that looks like in the strange situation. And I had a parent who had more this style, this avoidant attachment. And so there are parts of me that still were wired for kind of avoiding intimacy and avoiding emotion. Like, I'd much rather solve the problem and not think about that kind of stuff, right?
And when you're saying wiring, you're genuinely talking about the actual mapping in the brain.
Yes.
Like new neural connections that have strategized and said, this is the path to get this, to avoid pain, to seek pleasure.
Yes.
Now this is becoming ingrained. As you said, by 12 months, a lot of that patterning has been set up.
And what happens is that is these relational experiences get encoded in our implicit or procedural memory, which happens, you know, from the time we're born. Some people even say in utero, we start having these implicit procedural memories where basically our bodies and our subcortical regions below our cortex, the more primitive parts of our brain, make these wired associations, and we might not even have conscious awareness that that's why we're doing what we do.
Most times we don't have
conscious awareness. Most of the time
we
don't.
It's just like we're acting out these patterns and this default neural network.
That's right.
That we have.
And so, I want to give a message of hope here before we go into the other patterns or before we talk any further, because early attachment experiences, that first year, and the relational experiences we had with our parents growing up, they're really important, but they are not our destiny. They are not, we don't have to be, if you grew up with parents who did not provide you with secure attachment, who either harmed you or ignored your needs, or who were really chaotic and unpredictable themselves, the research shows, and I think this is sort of the punchline of this whole everything, which is that if the research shows that one of the best predictors for how kids turn out is that they have secure attachment with at least one person. And the second part of that is that the best predictor for how well we are able to provide secure attachment to our own children or to our significant others or to our friends is not whether or not we had it. Thank goodness.
So just like we use the example in functional medicine, you know, epigenetics, your genes are not your destiny.
Yep.
It's your lifestyle. You may have certain genes that make you more prone to obesity or bad at detoxifying or methylating, or you might have the genes that make you predisposed to Alzheimer's, but your lifestyle is way more important, even if you have those genes, because that'll determine how those genes are expressed.
That's exactly right.
So this isn't a blame your parents, everything is your parents' fault episode.
No.
Or to make parents hyper worried about stuff. Am I doing the right thing? Am I perfect in the way that I'm showing up? It's just talking about this secure attachment style and how we can bring it in even from day one today if we hadn't been doing it before or hadn't experienced it before.
That's right. Because the brain is wired from experiences, as soon as we start providing new experiences, the brain starts changing in response to that. And I think just like when you maybe on other podcasts are talking about, like, you may have this genetic predisposition, but you can make choices to do things differently. What's so encouraging and so hopeful is that this can be a call to action. So what we know that the single best predictor for how we are able to provide secure attachment to others is not that we had it or not, but whether or not we've reflected on those experiences. So even though they're sort of wired subcortically in the lower structures of the brain and in our nervous system, when we bring our cortex into the picture and we start kind of doing more of a reflection part and we go, I didn't really get that. I didn't have parents who showed up for me. I had parents, I didn't feel safe with my parents, or I didn't feel seen at all. They didn't know me. They, you know, they labeled me as their shy one and they didn't really know me at all, or they didn't allow me to express feelings, or I was criticized when I did, or whatever it is, to shine the light of reflection on that and say, I didn't get that, and that was hard for me, and here's how it's impacted me, and here's now how I'm going to be thinking about how I'm not going to pass that on in my future relationships. I'm going to be aware that that's there. Maybe I'll do some therapy or some journaling or some other kinds of reflecting, and as soon as we start making sense of our story, as soon as we have a coherent narrative about what happened to us and how it's affected us, then we actually can move back into that place where we can provide the kinds of communication and sensitive responsiveness in our relationships that allow our kids or our significant others to thrive and feel that those four S's from us.
And maybe even forgive our parents a little bit because they were just doing the best that they could.
That's how their
brains
were wired.
And maybe they didn't get that secure sense of attachment that's there. You know, there's a financial author, Dave Ramsey, and he always says that, you know, when you have the awareness, you can change your family tree. Mm-hmm. It was one way previously, then you wake up and it's not that way again.
That's right.
You know, just because you didn't have it or you grew up with this circumstance, you can change it moving forward.
Dan has a great quote about that. Dan Siegel, he says, without awareness, there isn't choice. Mm. Once you have awareness, you can kind of, he's got all these great terms. He says you can decouple automaticity. So like what's automatic, you can kind of take that apart and just begin to have a choice. So I love that.
It's a powerful quote. Yeah. I want to go back to the four types of attachment styles because I felt like we were really warming up the audience
and we
were getting
excited.
Really into it. So you were talking about one of them, which was, I believe, ambivalence.
Yeah.
Let's go to the next one to give an example to our audience. One of them is disorganized.
Yeah.
So what is disorganized attachment style and what are the repercussions on a child's behavior?
Yeah. So if you don't mind, I want to go back just one step.
Please.
Because we had the baby in the strange situation where they were sort of ignoring, they weren't showing their emotions and the parent was ignoring them. And that's the avoidant attachment. The next type is the preoccupied or the anxious ambivalent type, where in the strange situation, the baby usually would cry a whole lot. But then when the parent would come in and try to soothe the baby could not be soothed because they had a lot of anxiety and ambivalence and doesn't trust, like, this parent may not be here for long and I can't count on them to be predictable enough to help soothe me. So then we move to the disorganized attachment. And this one's tough to talk about because what attachment truly is, if we really peel it back to its essence, it is an inborn instinct that mammals have. And its purpose is to keep us alive. So what it really is when something frightens us or we are in distress in some way, physical pain, fear, whenever we feel our nervous system says there's a threat here, this inborn instinct drives us close. It makes us have proximity to someone who will take care of us. And when we do that, when we get close to that person, what it's supposed to do is help regulate our whole nervous system and help us feel like we're going to survive. That's the purpose and point of it. So what happens then is, let's say you're a chimpanzee in the jungle, you hear a scary snarling panther or you get hurt, you run to your attachment figure who will help you survive and be safe. That's really what
it's built in. It's an evolutionary safety mechanism inside of our biology.
Absolutely. So what happens with disorganized attachment, and in adulthood it's called unresolved, is that you have this powerful biological drive that takes you to your caregiver when you're in distress. But in this circumstance, your caregiver is the source of your distress. Mm. Your caregiver is the source of your threat. And in the literature, it's actually called, it's basically like a biological paradox, or it's unresolved fright. So you have one circuit that says, go to your caregiver to help you feel better and to feel like you're okay, and you have another circuit that says get the hell away from this dangerous person.
So in regards to disorganized attachment, there's the push and pull.
Yes. Yeah, there's this feeling of like I don't have safety anywhere. And so one of the things that we know is, you know, in the strange situation, these babies, they have really disorganized behaviors. They don't have, whereas with the other two that we just talked about and with secure attachment, the babies have a strategy to get the best from their parent. Like, oh, I'm going to hang on to my mom longer because then there's a better chance I'll get soothed. Or I'm not going to show emotion because that'll be better for my parent. They'll be nicer to me or whatever it is. In disorganized attachment, there isn't a strategy that works because you have a frightening caregiver. And so, and this is obviously where we would see cases of abuse and things like that. Often it's a parent who has a trauma history themselves and they have unresolved trauma. And so what can happen is the parent themselves can go into dissociated states or be very frightening to their children. And one of the very sad things about this is that having this type of attachment style in childhood is one of the best predictors we have for psychopathology later in life, struggling with significant ongoing mental health challenges. So it's really important that we get intervention when parents are frightening to their children.
So before we go back into secure attachment and what it means and what it looks like, I want to zoom out for a second here. And I've talked about this on other podcasts we've done about kids, parenting, you know, that whole area. My dad likes to say that we're sort of in like a unique evolutionary time where for the first time in probably human history in the last like 100 years, parents are kind of on their own. Yeah. We're not in these sort of villages raising kids together. How much of our relationship and, you know, this secure, the infant strain situation and the studies, these are from like the 1960s when really we started moving into these like nuclear households, suburbs, other stuff. How much of this is related to primarily now it's all on two people to provide the attachment for kids?
Yeah, you know, historically we did what's called alloparenting, right? Where we would raise kids together in these, we'd have many, many caregivers. And the caregivers didn't just help care for our young, but they helped care for the parents and they helped care in community. And now parents are so, and you know, I'm a parent to three boys. I know this from just my daily life that we are so stretched. And when we talk about secure attachment, so much of it is giving, tuning into our kids and then providing a sensitive response. But when we're stressed out and we are not getting enough sleep and our kids aren't getting enough sleep, so they're more dysregulated, this becomes more difficult to do. It's hard to show up and be present. And I think the other part related to that is, you know, we now have parents who, I guess we can, you know, people call it helicopter parenting. I think that's too passive of a word because that just means they're hovering. I think like curling parenting where you like brush the ice so there's no bumps on it at all so your kid can sail through, you know, without any adversity at all. Or maybe we call it hyper parenting. We feel like we have to do everything to make sure our kid has the best chance at everything. And parents are so hyper involved. And what this idea of secure attachment can tell us is you don't have to do all that. Your kid, what they need most from you is to be present, is to just show up and be present with them and tune into their lives and their daily, you know, experiences. And for the parents who are really distracted and chaotic themselves and we're distracted on our devices and we're distracted by being overscheduled, to say to those parents, myself included, what our kids need most from us is to be present and to show up. So it's sort of like we've got to come together in our modern society where we are sort of on our own and we're trying to make everything wonderful for our kids and we're trying to have these big lives. It's really hard to be present. We've got so many distractions. Dan Siegel and I were having this beautiful conversation and he was talking about how we've got the destruction of school violence and the violence in our world. And we've got the disconnection of feeling like we don't belong as part of these kind of bigger groups to care. And we've got the distraction of our devices. And then we've got the despair of the state of our planet. And so parents are saying, what are we to tell our children when we've got these four D's of, you know, this heaviness? And really, we can show up for them. We can't take away these things that happen. We can't change modern society necessarily in a day. But I think that the idea of being present and having people surrounding us, kind of creating our own tribe, so to speak, so that we have the supports to be able to be present, is huge.
NPR did a series that was following up with people that were on like a worldwide happiness study of parents. Mm-hmm. And they went and interviewed the tribe that was the happiest group of parents that were there. It was in Mexico.
Okay.
It was a tribe that was there. I forgot the name. I'm blanking on it. And they were talking to them like, you know, a lot of people see parenting as so distressful. It's very challenging. It's this. And they were just like, could not imagine how people felt that way because they had this tribal element where the kids had so many parents that were there, uncles, aunts, other components. So let's go back to, we'll come back to that and resources and tools that we can use to support the parents because it is so challenging. I'm not a parent myself. I've shared that in past episodes, but I'm doing all these episodes because I want to be a parent one day and I know my listeners are interested in this topic. So let's go into secure attachment style and build from there, because is it to say that secure attachment style is the preferred attachment style that we're shooting for to create for ourselves and our kids?
Absolutely. As mammals, that's what we need to survive and thrive. And since it's the best predictor for how kids turn out, this is really what we want in our lives. And we want it for our kids, but we also need it for ourselves. We need to feel safe, seen, soothed, and secure in our own relationships. You know, we need to feel that people show up for us. So what's interesting about this is in the strange situation, you know, the parent gets up and leaves, and sometimes these babies cry, sometimes they don't cry, but they're not distressed. So like their physiology, the mechanisms to measure that are showing these babies are not stressed out, because it's almost like they're crying or they're upset a little bit, but they're like, don't worry, I'm going to cry and she'll be right back. Like, they know they're not in distress because they believe their parent will be right back to show up for them and that their parent will come in. And what happens then is, even if the baby's crying but not in a stressed out state, the parent picks up the baby and the baby soothes quickly and returns to play. So what we see is almost this flexibility of attention where the baby can move its attention toward relationship, get its needs met, and then move back out into the world to play and these kinds of things. So over time then, these kids tend to be much more resilient. And what we know is that one of the outcomes of secure attachment is we see better function of some of the features that we know that the middle prefrontal cortex is responsible for. So when you look at the functions of the middle prefrontal cortex, there are many of them, but some of them would be like insight and empathy and sound decision making and being able to regulate your emotions and being able to regulate your body and having better morality and being more flexible. And so really, when you look at the functions of this middle prefrontal cortex, which is being developed well into our mid to late 20s, is that when people have experiences of secure attachment, we see these kinds of outcomes. We see higher empathy, higher insight, better flexibility, better able to regulate emotions, etc. So what we believe is that it's these secure relational experiences that actually help wire that part of the brain in a more, in a healthier way, in a more robust way, so that these kids really are more resilient in the face of adversity and don't deal with the same kinds of relational and emotional struggles.
So let's break those down that you had mentioned. Safe, seen, soothed, secure. So yeah. So safe, is it as simple as, like, you know, I mean, most people, if you're probably listening to this podcast, you are probably in a privileged situation. You have some resources and means that are there, just in terms of like just thinking about demographics, who has the time to listen to podcasts, who has the ability, the technologies are there. Yeah. So is safety simply, like, break that down. Like, what is the range? Is there a range, or is there a spectrum of safety that's there?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we say first is that when we're thinking about safety, it really is simply what you're talking about here, which is first, do no harm. And as parents, you know, as much as we adore our kids and it's like being in love to the nth degree and we would never let anyone harm them, sometimes as parents, we flip our lids and we scream and yell at them, or we maybe yank their arm too hard when we're trying to get them into the car, or different things like that, or far worse. One of the things we know from the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, that was done originally at Kaiser and then has been replicated in many, many places, shows that the incidence of kids who experience physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, or neglect is far higher than anyone ever imagined. I mean, it really is a very common thing, even in people who have really privileged demographic profiles. And so the first part of safety is that we don't want to be the parent who is the source of threat or the source of fear for our children. We want our children's biological circuitry to only say, go to my caregiver when I'm in distress and they will help protect me.
And I've heard you in past interviews, and you've shared that there's even microwaves that parents do this without realizing it, just ways that they were parented. For example, this idea of a child is not listening to you, right? They're not being obedient in the way that a parent would say that this kid is being obedient. They're like, okay, I'm just going to leave without you. We're leaving now. Right. Bye. So is that an example of kind of a kid?
Yeah, I mean, I think
on a mild level.
On a mild level. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we tell kids all the time things like, you know, if I can't see you, I can't keep you safe, and you need to stay with me when we're here in the store. And we do all of these safety kinds of things with our kids. And then when they won't come with us and we can't get cooperation, then we often will threaten our kids and we'll say, you know, I'm going to leave you here if you don't come. And, you know, sometimes kids, that works. And then other times kids are like, good, now I can stay here and play longer. And then parents have to resort to a bigger threat, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, I think we want our kids to know that we will keep them safe. And let me just give an example of this for like an older kid. So, you know, I have three teenage boys now. And so, you know, and I'm careful about how I talk about them to protect their privacy. But obviously high schoolers experiment with drugs and alcohol at times. And, you know, I was talking to this other mom who had kids the same age, And she was like, okay, I know my kid was drinking. You know, I think, I don't know what I should do. Should I, you know, should I punish him? Should I put him on restriction? And so we talked about lots of options. And what I really coached her to do, and what I've done myself when my kids have done things that I felt like were not safe, is instead of coming in screaming and yelling, which can trigger a threat response, making it less likely they can actually learn and hear what I'm saying, is to say to my kid, my number one job is to keep you safe. And if you are making decisions to not keep yourself safe, then I'm going to step in to make sure you're safe. And so that's where maybe you take the keys of the car away, or you know, say you can't spend time with that group of friends, or, you know, whatever it is. But to really say safety first is the most important thing in terms of the brain. If we're having a threat response, if our nervous system and our I'm a big fan of Stephen Porges and his polyvagal theory. Mm-hmm. If our neuroception, which is his term, detects threat or danger in our environment, we can go into a reactive state where we can't be receptive, we can't learn, we can't make decisions. So
you're saying that even sometimes kids can't even hear you.
They
physically can't hear you. You know, parents are always like, are you listening to me? Are you listening to me? The kid's in a threat state. You're saying that something's physically actually going on that the kids can't hear.
That's
at that
right.
full level.
And Porges even talks about how our social engagement circuitry, which includes our inner ear muscle, actually changes so that we literally cannot process auditory input unless it's threatening sounding. So, you know, in No Drama Discipline, Dan and I talk about how the brain is either in a receptive state or in a reactive state. When kids are having big behaviors and misbehaving, we often, and so they're totally dysregulated. They're not making decisions. They're not receptive at all. We often will like yell at them or threaten them or things like that, that actually make it even less likely they can learn and they can do better the next time. So a lot of our discipline approaches are totally counterproductive. But safety is the key. We want our kids to always feel safe with us. That does not mean being permissive. That does not mean not having boundaries. So I can absolutely
necessarily consequences, like you were saying, like taking the keys away,
that's
doing
right.
things like that.
That's right. And how we do consequences matters a whole lot. Like, I'll give you an example with my middle schooler. If I find that he's on his phone instead of doing his homework, I can say, okay, fine, I'm taking your phone away. You know, that's your punishment. Or I can say to him, and I'm taking the phone away either way. But my second scenario, much better in my opinion, is to say, I can tell that having the phone in your room when you're doing your homework is too tempting for you. So during homework times, I'm going to be holding onto your phone until you build the skills to have the discipline to have your phone in your room with you. So the whole point of discipline is to raise kids who are self-disciplined. And when you go back to the meaning of the word discipline, it actually means to teach. So when kids have misbehaviors or they're doing things that are not okay, they're giving you the list. They're like, I don't have skills in these areas yet. I don't have strategies that work well for me. So if we want their behavior to change, we have to change our behavior. And really, if we can hold onto the idea that always discipline is about teaching so that they can do better the next time, it could actually revolutionize how we think about discipline. A lot of what we do in the name of discipline is counterproductive because it activates a threat state, making it less likely kids can learn.
And again, just like I always want to share, you know, I don't have kids, but it's like this is so applicable to every area of life. There's so many bosses, you know, as somebody who is the employer of almost 60 people with my business partner, there's so many times that I see how my, you know, not really my friends, but other people run their company. It's like you are treating your employees like kids, trying to discipline them in the traditional sense. And what kind of outcome and behavior are you think that it's going to lead to?
Yeah. And when they show you those behaviors, I really believe that behavior is communication. They're basically saying, Drew, I don't have consistent skills in this area, or I don't have a strategy that works well for me. So that's kind of an invitation for you to say, hey, why don't we try this? Or, you know, why don't you read this book? Or, you know, something like that.
Like helping them grow.
Skills. Absolutely.
So let's go to the next one, scene. So
can I say one more thing about safe?
Yes.
So the other piece of safety, and this is sort of the second take home besides first do no harm, the second take home in that chapter and in that approach is the idea that as parents, as significant others, we're going to mess up. We just are, because our nervous system, our neuroception is going to go into threat. We're going to react at times. And so the key is we're going to mess up in all of our relationships. And the key is, and this is the take home, is repair. So when we mess up, when we say things or do things in relationships, particularly with our kids, when we make them feel afraid, is to go back and say, I didn't handle myself well there. I really wish I had handled that differently. Was that scary for you, or did that feel badly to you? And really to just make amends. And when we repair, it actually can be really good for our kids in a couple of ways. So we can kind of like give ourselves some relief, because as parents, you know, sometimes I have a friend who I told her one time about a time with my three-year-old. He kept hitting me, and I was trying all these different strategies. And at one point, I kind of flipped my lid and I said, "If you stick that tongue out one more time, I'm going to rip it out of your mouth." So like, I threatened to remove a body part of my kid, you know, not good. So I called my friend and I was like, "I just feel so bad about it." And she's like, "Oh, that's nothing." She's like, "I wake up every day and I just say, don't be evil today. You know, just be nice today." So we all have these ruptures. And I think the key is, when we go back and repair, not only are we modeling how to make repair, but we're also giving them a rep, that we're giving their brain a rep or an experience to say, look, there can be conflict and distress in relationships, and then you can make it right again. So we're actually expanding their window of tolerance for conflict in a relationship. I mean, if we were lovely all the time, the world would be a really terrifying place, right? So we're giving them enough safety and enough support with that adversity of relational conflict.
Them that people mess up.
Yeah.
And then you can repair, and they're going to mess up too.
And they don't have to be perfect. Exactly.
I mean, imagine if your kid never saw you apologize.
Ugh.
Like, how crazy.
That happens a lot.
That happens a lot. I know people who have been through that. So let's move to scene. What is scene and how does it show up when it comes to secure attachment?
Yeah, I love this one so much. This is really about being known. And when someone looks at you, instead of just looking at your behavior, they really kind of peel the layers back and get to what's underneath that behavior. So you have a kid who is like oppositional and like won't smile for the camera or whatever. And, you know, you can say, are you feeling a little bit embarrassed? Is that what's going on? And you can kind of get what's inside. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day that was telling me how her daughter was having this massive tantrum about some toy she wanted. And the mom was like, "I'm sorry, you know, we're not buying a toy for you today." And the daughter was just falling apart. And she said, "I first started going down the path of saying, you know, I told you we weren't going to buy something for you. You know, you're so spoiled," and to kind of go down that route. But instead, she's like, "I remembered seeing," and she just got down with her daughter. And she said, "You really wanted that toy. That looked really, it was really cute. You really liked it. Is that right?" And the daughter's like, "Yes," like, she got it, right? And she's like, "I know, it's so disappointing when we can't have what we want." That's that moment of sort of being seen. So what scene is really about is having your internal experience and it's matched by the external response. So someone sees you. Dan talks about it as feeling felt, which is a really beautiful phrase.
Yeah, and we did, I was chatting with you. We did an episode with Jennifer Kulari, who I know you mentioned you don't know her. I would love to connect you guys.
I know,
you guys
would love to.
You guys are doing such great work together, all on mirror neurons.
Yeah.
And in her episode and a lot of her work is about that component. And how just as important it is for, before a child is receptive, or a human being by that means, this feeling of like, I feel like this person gets me.
Yeah.
So now I can go on the journey. In fact, I was listening to an interview that you had on leadership. There was a podcast you did on leadership. I forget the name
of
the podcast.
That was a fun one. I can't remember either.
And you were sharing how, you know, you had your older son who had starred the younger son, which means that he slapped him and left like a little star mark on him.
The 5 points of the fingers
made
a star.
Of the finger. That before going to him, say, "Why did you do that?" And like, you know, this and the threat state and him not listening. You were like, you know, you really were having him seen. Yeah. You know, I can tell you're upset. Like, what's going on? What did you notice? What happened in this situation?
You're so mad. Is that
right? You're so mad. Yeah. And then now being able to have him go on that. Actually, can you complete that story? Because I think it'd be nice to share that.
So my sons were probably about 8 and 5 at the time. And my son, Luke, came running in to find me. And he said, "JP5 starred me." And I said, "What does that mean?" And he lifted up his shirt and I could see JP's handprint on his back. And first I comforted Luke. "Are you okay? That looks like it really stings. You know, do you want me to put a cloth?" So that's again, you know, sort of being seen and soothed and him feeling safe, like my mom's got my back, all those S's. And this is actually a great story to talk about how we handle behaviors and stuff while using the 4 S's. So as soon as Luke kind of went on his way, you know, then it was time to kind of address the perpetrator, right? To deal with the discipline. Like, it's not okay to hit in our house, right? So I come around the corner and JP, my little guy, was just just furious. I mean, there was practically steam coming out of his ears. And, you know, because I do what I do, I'm thinking of polyvagal theory, and I'm saying, oh, he's in a hyper aroused state and his heart rate is elevated and his blood pressure is elevated and his muscle tone is tight and, you know, his respiration's increased. And I know he's in this threat response,
yeah,
right?
He feels like he was the victim.
Absolutely.
Genuinely.
Absolutely. Genuinely. So if I go with like the typical parental response would be like, go tell your brother you're sorry, which he doesn't care that he hurt his brother at this point. He's
even if he
mad.
Does it, it's not real.
It's not real, right? Or I throw some random consequence. And what happens usually for parents is we throw out a consequence that we just, the first thing that comes to our mind, and then our rational, you know, cognition comes up with a way to rationalize it. Like I'm like, I'm taking away your play date. And then my cortex slowly catches up and I'll say, because you clearly can't be with people today, you know, or whatever. I'll come up with a way to justify it. Or I might yell at him, like, why in the world would you hit your brother? Or worse, I would say, well, now I'm going to hit you, right? So these might be, you know, instincts or what a lot of parents would do. And I would be tempted, you know, to yell at that moment. But if I can keep regulated myself, that's the most important thing for my kids to feel safe, is to know that I'm going to be even as best I can. And so then I could say to JP, oh, JP, you're so mad. What happened? Come here. And I responded to him as if he were physically hurt. He's in emotional distress, right? And he tells me the story about how his brother had told the punchline of a story he was telling to the grandparents on the phone. And he kept trying and the big brother kept interrupting him. And he said, I tried to use my words after we got off the phone, but he made fun of me. So I five-starred him. And I said, oh, that would have made me so frustrated too. I don't like it when people interrupt me. And so his internal experience is matched by me. He feels seen. And empathy is the fastest way to actually move any human being from a reactive state back into a regulated receptive state. So I just pour on the empathy. I'm so sorry that happened. That must have been so upsetting. And as I do that, within a couple of minutes, I feel his physiological state move back into a regulated state. His breathing regulates, his muscle tone softens, sort of feel like he's focused back on me again. And then I could say, you know, it's not okay to hurt your brother. It's okay to get mad, but it's not okay to do that. So what was happening for you? How did you know you were getting mad? How did you feel like in your body? How can you make things right with Luke? You know, so then we kind of do this reflective dialogue.
What could you do different next time?
What could you do differently next time? Yeah, what happens if you get that big anger feeling again, you know, and all of that? And we could have that conversation. And at the end of that conversation, have I taught? Yes. Have we, you know, we've done insight and empathy and we've done all these things. We've done problem solving. And I actually don't think that I have to throw a consequence there. In fact, I think it might be counterproductive. Had instead I just thrown a consequence at him, a punishment, like I'm taking away your play date, I think he would have gone to his room and spent a lot of time thinking about how his brother wronged him and it's his brother's fault and they love Luke more than me. And he would feel like the victim. Whereas when I soothed him first, and connected with him first, and Dan and I call it connect and redirect a lot of times too, then he was able to get back into a receptive state, and then he could take responsibility. Like, yeah, because I said, hey, you really
said,
hurt
like,
your brother.
There's a healthy form of guilt that showed up. Like a healthy form of evolution. Like guilt is not a bad thing.
Right. So there's a big difference between a conscience and healthy guilt, which I think is really interesting if we think back about sort of our evolutionary process and survival, that if you violate the mores of your group, you're likely to get kicked out. And if you're alone out in the jungle, you're more likely to get eaten. So you have to be with people in order to survive in our evolutionary old brain, right? And so we have this feeling of guilt or this healthy conscience where if we violate the mores of our group, it feels bad. We're like, oh, that, and guilt feels terrible.
And that actually changes behavior in the future.
Totally.
Versus domination. I can remember
totally.
As a kid, when my dad was truly disappointed, where I mm-hmm. knew that I kind of messed up, that hurt the most because I felt like, oh, I let him down. Like he really has my back.
Yeah.
You know, I messed up here. And that actually I would notice
it
that
changes.
Would change my behavior versus a temporary thing
power
that came
control.
Out of brute force.
Totally. Absolutely.
Components. So it's not that you, I mean, that's, we're really talking about like how to support our kids to change their brains.
Totally.
And what's the best path to be able to do that.
Yeah. It's cool because, and then shame's a very different animal, you know, and really what happened there is I let JP feel that guilt. So I actually had taken a picture of Luke's star, not for presentation speaking purposes, but because Luke couldn't see it and he wanted to see it. So once JP was regulated again, I said, hey, I want to show you what you did to Luke's back. And I showed him the picture and he kind of hung his head and kind of went into that like, oh yeah, I feel badly about that. And that's such a beautiful moment because it means he's thinking about the mind of another, right? It's evidence that his prefrontal is wiring up empathy and that he feels connected and all of these things.
Because some people are listening and they're like, you spent all this time and you're soothing him and then he's conning you and they have this sort of like feeling and it's like, is that really even going to work?
Yeah.
And what you're talking about is that because he had that guilt and there was some connections and it was kind of walked through that journey, this is actually something where there's a shift that is happening inside the brain rather than just a default pattern that develops in the future.
And he had to take accountability in that moment. He had to go, oh gosh, look what I did. And how can I make things right? So this is a sort of like a more restorative justice. Again, had I just thrown a consequence at him, I don't think he would have taken any responsibility. He would have felt like the victim. So what happened here is I gave him an opportunity. So a couple things happened. And I do think a lot about this idea of reps. Like when we lift muscles, we get a rep, the muscle gets stronger. So the brain got a rep there going from a dysregulated, out of control state back into a regulated state through connection and being seen and feeling safe and soothed by me. And so then what we know is that after repeated experiences, this does not make kids indulged and spoiled. This actually trains their brain for how to regulate themselves. So the brain gets practice going from this dysregulated state back into a regulated state so he can learn to do that for himself. And the second thing that happened was that he also had an experience of having to take responsibility for something and to go make things right and think about how his behavior affected someone else. And then we talked about what do you do differently next time. And I think it's not only does it feel good, and it actually doesn't take that much more time because when you start doing, otherwise you yell, go to your room, I'm taking your thing away. And then you end up having a big battle. And then everyone's unhappy. So it actually doesn't take necessarily more time. And it saves us time because it's effective. And he's less likely to do that again the next time. And so over time, it actually makes our kids much more well-disciplined and self-disciplined.
Because we all know people who were grown up in a very strict household.
Yeah.
And then just later on, when they've got the first taste of freedom, completely rebelled and went in a different direction.
Yeah.
If being strict was the way to permanently change behavior, then that would be working.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, people say like, oh, you don't have to think so much about what you eat and just eat healthy. Just eat healthy. It's like, okay, well, what does that mean? We actually have to think about it a little bit because if you look around, clearly the advice from the government or from people's doctors, most doctors that are out there, are just like, oh, just eat healthy and watch your calories and that sort of, it's not working.
No.
So this process of thinking through this is dissecting it a little further. And as you had mentioned before, saves time in the long run because we're teaching people and helping kids grow their brain in the right direction.
Yeah. And if in the moment we get so frustrated, we scream and yell, then we go back to and we say, gosh, I screamed and yelled. I didn't want to, but I got really angry and I didn't handle my anger well. And I'm going to work on that. And so we model that process as well.
Let's go to the next one, which is soothe.
Yeah. This is very connected to scene because I feel like when we see our kids as they really are and what they're really experiencing, if I see JP and I go, oh my gosh, he's so angry. He really tried his best and those big feelings really kind of overtook him. That's a really stressful state for someone to be in. I don't know if you've ever been in a state where you're really out of control. It's very stressful. And so if I see him, then it's so much easier for me to say, I've got you, baby. I'm going to help you. I'm going to help you calm down. Versus if I see my kid being a brat on purpose who's trying to do, you know, mean things to me, it's going to be much harder to get to soothed. So I think approaching our kids or our partners' difficult behavior with curiosity and say, wonder what that's about, that can help us with the soothed. Because I said I love polyvagal theory, I do often think about the nervous system. You know, the brain is embodied, so we can't just ever think about a brain as an organ in our skull. It's part of our whole nervous system, as you know. And so I often think about how when my kids are really upset or my husband's really upset or whatever, I almost think about like a volume dial, like their nervous system's turned up way too high. Or if they're like depressed and checked out and, you know, pulling away, that's like their volume's down too low. So one of the things I think about in terms of soothed is it's my job to kind of help turn down the volume on that nervous system intensity. And empathy and connection is the most powerful way to do this. One of my favorite things, a woman who works with me named Hannah. She's a speech and language pathologist. We were talking one day about the different brain, sort of the triune brain, the brainstem and the limbic region and the prefrontal region, and how the you know, all of them care about safety, but particularly sort of brainstem and amygdala, limbic area really are always on the watch for am I safe or whatever. And so one of the things we were talking about in terms of what we want to provide in our therapy practice and in our relationships and all of these things is really this series of sort of three sentences which mirror what each of those brain regions in that order need, which is to say to someone, you're safe, I'm with you, that's the safe and seen, and then we'll figure this out together, right? So like, you're safe, I'm with you, we'll figure it out together. And to kind of get those steps going. So when kids feel safe, or when our partners feel safe, any adult, any brain's like this, safe, and then someone gets them, someone sees them, and the way the person responds is mirroring what our internal state is. And then they're there to kind of help us calm down. Like, how can I help? I'm right here with you. Or, you're so mad at me, I'll listen. Those kinds of things.
What are examples for when you look around and you see adults who have not been taught how to soothe from a young age and didn't feel like there was people around them?
Yeah.
And they weren't given these practices. Like, what are the manifestations of someone as an example for our audience who never had that? Like, what do you see out there?
Well, there's some really very common ones that I have been guilty of doing too. It's very funny, you know, we often will tell kids not to feel something. So we'll say like, what are you so scared of? I don't know why you're afraid. There's no such thing as monsters and mummies that live in your room. Like, just, you know, it's not a big deal. Just don't be afraid. And kids are never like, okay, thanks, that's really helpful, you know.
You're right.
Or or we say, like, I was on an airplane recently with a four-year-old that was almost like manic dysregulated. She was squealing and screaming and crying, and she was sort of all over the place and laughing really loudly, and the dad just kept yelling at her to calm down. He was like, calm down, calm down, you need to settle your body down, calm down. And it wasn't helping. Like, she, you know, so you might have a parent yelling at a kid to calm down, or you might have a parent yelling at a kid to go to sleep, or these kinds of things, or telling a kid not to feel, like, quit being such a baby about that. You know, why are you such a crybaby? Why is that such a big deal? You need to toughen up. You know, those are the kinds of things we say to kids. Or we assume that the child's behavior, I think one of the biggest mistakes we make when it comes to kids who are really having a hard time is we assume that every behavior is a willful decision that the kid makes. We all know, and we know this well from the research, is that when we have a significant stress response, we kind of have this dysregulated state where we've kind of flipped our lids and we're not our best self, and we go into these hyper-stressed states or these hyper-aroused states or these hypo-aroused states, we actually can't think clearly. We're not making a decision. We're just in threat survive mode. And so a lot of times what happens, instead of soothing the kid, saying, I see you're having a really hard time and I'm going to help you, is we get mad at the kid and we say, you need to pull it together. If you don't pull it together, here's what's going to happen. And we basically threaten them.
I mean, privately, there are, if I could interject, there are friends or family members or just individuals that I've seen out there that genuinely have a belief that my child is manipulative.
Yeah.
My child's manipulative. I have this belief. And so I have to combat their manipulation.
Yeah, you know, what's really funny is I think as parents, we often parent to a crowd when there's people, especially if you have someone in your life who thinks you're too permissive or they think you're too strict. We kind of...
somebody said something to you once, that kid is walking all over
you.
Then you develop this belief system and you start treating this kid as hostile, who you love and is your kid.
Right.
But that becomes the primary way of interacting with
them. Yeah, I think, you know, manipulation is a really interesting thing, and people ascribe the capacity to do that way earlier than it actually is even possible in the brain. Manipulation is a really sophisticated skill. It really is. You have to kind of think about, like, what is it I want? What'll convince you to give it to me? Like, I have to think about your mind. Like, it's a really sophisticated. So people are like, oh, my baby's manipulating me to be picked up. They're
Instead
6 months.
Just understanding that it's a coping mechanism.
The baby's communicating. The baby's communicating. I need to be picked up. Right. And
Or the baby is just like showing back a response of what it needs to feel soothed or feel secure.
Yeah. And I think we have to be really, it's really interesting. We still have a lot of things left over from the behaviorism research days that are just not true and accurate anymore. And including one of the things I hear a lot around this manipulation thing is they're like, oh, well, she's just trying to get your attention. Those are attention seeking behaviors. She's manipulating you to get your attention. Well, if you think about the purpose of attention, if you want someone's attention, it's because you're probably trying to meet a need. Like if you are a chimp in the jungle and let's say you're a little baby lion cub and your parent does not give you attention, some predator could come and take you and your parent won't even notice. So attention is actually a way that we feel safer. It's a way that we feel that our needs are going to be seen and met. So typically the advice is typically ignore attention seeking behavior. But attention is a need, just like eating and sleeping is. And if it's a need, the more you ignore it, the bigger the kid's behavior has to get in order to get that need met.
Right. So it's sort of like a two-part question. Why does the child why are they exhibiting this behavior?
Yeah.
Is it because of previous behavior that the parent, you know, had? Because how the parent is interacting with the kid is a symbiotic relationship of what's deciding to become the attachment style.
Yeah.
And so if you ignore it, you are now furthering that behavior.
Yeah. And I want to just be really clear, helping your kid feel safe, seen, and soothed is not permissive parenting. You can have really good boundaries, really, really good boundaries, and have really high expectations and still do these four S's. And I'll give an example of that. For example, I told a story a little about my little guy, JP, and he was probably 4 or 5, and he was so tired. He didn't want to take a bath, so he had a big meltdown about getting in the bath. I finally get him in the bath. Then when he's in the bath, he has a big meltdown about getting out of the bath, you know, and parents, you all out there that are listening, you know how this goes. He was having a meltdown because he wanted a particular Lego guy in the bath with him, and, you know, we couldn't find the Lego guy. And so then when I say, hey, it's about time to get out, he starts using this really hilarious reasoning. He's like, well, this isn't a bathtub and I'm not even in a bath, so you can't get me out. You know, he's like trying all these things. So it's time for him to get out, and I have the boundary. I'm not going to be like, okay, honey, like because you're crying, I'm going to give in to you. Okay. So when kids have big, you know, when kids are crying and throwing a fit and screaming and yelling, and we give in on the boundary and the behavior, that's not good. It doesn't help kids feel safe. Because having predictability helps kids feel safer. So following through with that, I can say to him, like, it's time to get out of the bathtub, and either you can get out or I'm going to help you get out. And he does not get out. And as I'm pulling him out of the bathtub and I'm holding my boundary of it's time to get out, I can say, you're so mad about having to get out of the bathtub right now. You're so upset, and you can cry and yell if you need to. I'm right here with you as you're this upset, right? So I'm still holding the boundary. I'm saying no to the behavior of staying in the bathtub, but I'm saying yes to your feelings and yes to your expression of feelings. And what happens a lot of times as parents or with our partners too, is if we blame them for, you know, well, if you had listened in the first place, you wouldn't be upset about this. Or, you know, we blame them, or we dismiss their feelings, like, why are you being such a baby about this? Or, well, you have nothing to be afraid of. You know, we're happy in this family, and if you're going to cry, you need to go to your room and cry. When we kind of blame or minimize or even distract our kids from their feelings, what happens is, it's not just that moment. We're also communicating, look, I'm only interested in being in relationship with you when you've got it together. And if you've got big feelings and problems, I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to see it. You go do it over there, right? And so that's kind of the opposite message of what we as parents really want to be communicating to our kids. What attachment tells us at its essence is that these attachment drives are activated in distress. What that says is that in our moments of distress, that's when we most need connection. And I'm like that. I mean, when I have something really upsetting happening or I'm really stressed about something, that's when I most need my people.
I mean, I think most people
would it's agree an attachment
that they feel
drive.
That way too.
Yeah. So I think when kids are in distress and they have these big behaviors, we often forget that they may need connection first before we redirect the behaviors, before we address the behaviors. But I think manipulation is often really we're sort of, we throw that out as if kids walk around all the time being master manipulators. And I think at times kids do manipulate, but I think they're also trying to communicate and get their needs met.
And adults, it's kind of like, I always like listen to like parents who are like telling their kids like, don't lie, don't lie, don't lie. Parents lie to their kids all
yeah.
the time.
Yeah.
I often look at like parents are manipulating their kids. Yeah. I can remember being a kid and my parents were, you know, I feel great about how yeah. I was parented and everything like that. And there was so much of this. I was, my older sister, shout out to Herschel, who was the one who was reading your book,
good.
Even though we are connected through Dan and Dina and that community. And I've seen the stuff that's out there. My older sister was reading your book and was like, sent us a screenshot and said like, our parents were just naturally doing this. Like, it's
awesome.
Very super unique. And she has kids and she was thinking about that. And I was chatting with her about how a lot of times parents are the ones manipulating their kids.
Totally.
And they're the ones that are trying to like get them to just do this thing. Just do this thing and everything will be okay. So I interpret it as when your kids don't feel safe and seen, especially in the beginning, and you jump right to trying to get to the solution, your version of the solution, because your priorities are more important than the kids' priorities, right, in your eyes, then they can exhibit behavior back that can feel manipulative, but you started it off.
Yeah.
Like you started off and they're just responding to that instead of meeting them where they are and seeing them. I mean, I'm talking theoretical.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens when I have kids and I get a chance to practice some of this stuff.
Yeah.
But I actually think, I know I'm talking a lot, but the other thing that I'll add in is that the unique thing is because we're all raising kids kind of in isolation, not in a village. I actually think it's important for people who don't have kids to talk more about this stuff.
For sure.
To have these conversations, to think about it so that they go into it not blind, whereas previously would have had a lot more experience with kids being in more of a village and a community and seeing how the elders did it and seeing, oh, that leads to better results. I'm not going to just bully my kid into submission.
That's absolutely right. And, as a clinician, you know, I've met with so many families where, you know, they were really like, we believe in strict discipline. We think our kids are, you know, I had this family I worked with, and obviously I always change details to protect privacy, but this family, you know, this kid refused to stay at school. And the goodbyes were so terrible. Like the kid would get so dysregulated, he would rip his mom's clothes to try to, or like bite her or do whatever he could to keep her from leaving. And so as I was, I'm always like trying to invoke the parents' curiosity, and I do that by modeling that. And so I say, you know, I'm really curious, why do you think, you know, this is happening? And the parents were like, well, he's just manipulating. And so then I would kind of follow up that, manipulating for what? What is he trying to gain? Well, he just likes to go home. He just wants to be home instead of at school. Okay, what's so great about being at home? And the mom starts like questioning this. She's like, yeah, when he comes home and he, you know, I let him come home from school, I don't let him do anything fun. Like I make him do chores and like schoolwork and stuff. So I don't really know why he would be doing that. And you know, as I start to talk with the parents more, we start kind of trying to peel the layers back to figure out why is their kid so dysregulated. And it turned out this kid had a sensory processing challenge, and that being in a large crowd with a lot of kids overwhelmed his little nervous system. So he was grabbing onto his mom because his threat circuitry was getting activated at drop off. And so she was his best strategy to stay safe. But they saw his behavior as manipulative. And so I said, well, if you think his behavior is manipulative, what's the answer? And the parents said, strict or discipline. And I said, well, what have you been trying? And they said, oh, stricter discipline. You know, like they had been doing that and it wasn't working. And so I said, why don't we try something together? Which is much better than saying, you know, I want you to radically change your parenting. We start with, let's try an experiment, right? So I coached this dad in particular who would get into these battles with his son where his kid would demand something. The dad was like, you're so spoiled, you can't have it. And the dad would scream at his kid, and the kid would scream, and then the kid would kick his dad, and then the dad would drag him to his room and hold the door to keep him in timeout, and the kid would destroy the room. I mean, like, it just, they were having these kind of everybody falling apart moments repeatedly. So I walked the parents through the four S's, and knowing that, you know, this was going to feel really foreign and that they were going to be afraid that if they parented in this way, their kid would be spoiled. And I said, let's just try it as an experiment. So I coached the dad the next time his kid went into this tantrum state to practice the four S's. And I said, I want you to get down below eye level. Like, this seems weird. And I said to the dad, I want you to get below eye level to your kid and sit in a really relaxed posture. And he said, you want me to sit in a submissive posture to my child? And I said, no, it's a strategic posture to downregulate his nervous system. Anyway, and I said, I want you to stop yelling and I want you to only say two things. One, something empathetic, like, oh, buddy, you're so angry right now. And two, to say, I'm right here with you. And I said, that's all I want you to say, and let's just see what happens. So I didn't think I would ever see them again. But a couple weeks later, they came back, and the dad said, I'll admit, I thought that was the dumbest thing ever. And I told my wife, I'm never doing that. Like, that was a waste of time and money. And I said, so did you just come back to share that with me, or how can I help you today? I didn't know really why they had come back. And he said, well, in a moment of desperation, my kid was raging, and I sat on the floor. He said, I don't think I did it exactly right. I said, I can tell you're mad, but I'll sit here with you. And I was like, that's great progress, right? And he said, my kid calmed down faster than I've ever seen him calm down. But something else happened, and that was that I was able to stay calm. And this is really interesting if we think about Amy Cuddy's work on the power pose. You know, she talks about the power pose. And we think about how we believe, a lot of us, that emotion starts in our brain, and it does and can. But emotion definitely starts in our body first. And it's a long time before our slow cortex picks up that that's what we're feeling.
Yeah, it's felt in our body first, and then like millisecond or a little bit faster than that, then it's recognized and processed.
Exactly. So I said to this dad, your brain's an association machine. So when you stand over your kid and you use an aggressive voice and an aggressive tone of voice and you shake your finger at him and you yell at him, there's a call for neural response related to those body postures. Like, everything related to these body postures, please get activated. So it actually activates fight circuitry in you. But if you sit below eye level and you force yourself, even though you want to yell and you're mad, if you force yourself to say something empathetic, you're going to activate totally different neural circuitry and a totally different neural network in your own brain that allows you then, you know, and kid, like this dad was like, well, if I'm like soft with him and if I comfort him and help him feel seen and soothed and all that, he's not going to respect me. And I was like, you know what? I understand that fear. But when you lose your cool and you scream and yell, your kid doesn't respect you as much as if you stay in control and you have the power and the control of keeping yourself regulated and to say, I can tell you're upset and I'm right here with you. Like, you're like this soft, strong, you know, safe person in that moment. And what was this one change for this family was revolutionary. And what happened is what I see happen in schools. I mean, I've taught this to lots and lots of individuals and programs, is that when kids start to have a hard time and they know they get in trouble for it, then actually it can make behaviors worse, because the kid not only has the big feelings that come up just naturally because they're brains aren't done developing yet, and they're immature in certain ways, but then they also have the anxiety and fear of, oh no, I can't help this sometimes and I'm going to get in trouble, versus a kid who's like, oh no, I might get really mad in a minute and I don't know if I can stop myself and someone's going to help me, right? What happens then, and this is what happened in many, many families, is that the behaviors and the reactivity actually start to lower and lower and lower. And so then, instead of the dad screaming and the kid screaming and both of them having tantrums daily, it went down to fewer and fewer times and just a few times a week. And this has happened in many, many families I've worked with. It is so powerful because it's our mammal instinct. If we can help someone else feel safe and seen and soothed. And so that over time, that kid expects, like, if I'm really falling apart and I'm really in distress, someone's going to show up for me and they're going to help me. Then you don't see as big of behaviors.
It's so simple. And yet it's the foundation of just what, you know, starts it off and does not put you in that cycle that so many families feel like they're in the cycle of the constant tantrums or the constant back and forth battle that's there.
Yeah.
That's exhausting. And parents are just trying to do their best. But it's so simple. And anybody who's listening to it is like, is it really that simple? It's simple, but it's a lot of work still.
And it takes practice.
You know, you have this quote that I pulled. You say, the brain develops what it gets practiced doing. So both for kids and for parents is just the regular practicing of it. Your own regulating your own fight or flight state. Letting go and being aware of your own patterns that you were raised in.
That's right.
Your own frustrations that may not have anything to do with the kid might be related to work and you're taking out on them.
That's right.
Might be related into your feeling of isolation and that I'm the primary one that's disciplining my kid because my husband is not as involved.
Right.
My wife is not involved. So many things related to kids I can just see, and I knew that as a kid.
Totally.
Has nothing to do with like not nothing, but it's not always about the kid and their own behavior. There's so many other life factors that are there. And when you step out of your own default neural network, you're also creating the awareness and freedom for your kids to begin doing that process too.
That's exactly right. And remembering kind of where we started, which is that our own experiences are encoded in our implicit and procedural memory. And so what happens is we may play things out in our relationships with our kids because that is what happened with our parents and we're not even aware of it. And so what happens then is as we begin to kind of reflect on the parent we want to be, and we start to look at how our parents showed up or didn't show up for us. You know, did I feel safe with my parents? Or like, under what circumstances did I not feel safe? Did they know me? Did I feel like they got me? They saw me for who I was, not who they wanted me to be. Did they understand what I felt? And then did they show up to help me get calm and to help me through difficult situations and soothe me when I was in distress or not? You know, where, in what ways did they not show up for me? And as we can begin to look at that, then we can begin to kind of shine the light of awareness on ways that we may be acting out of some of that without even being aware. Yeah.
So true. And, you know, when you think about adults that didn't experience this as a kid, weren't in a secure attachment, again, it can vary so much.
Yeah.
But what are some of their behaviors as adults or patterns that you sometimes see, even if they don't have kids? Let's say that they're single or whatever stage that they're in life,
dating,
or whatever age.
Married,
What are some of the examples of patterns of behaviors that can manifest as adults that people see that they wouldn't necessarily make the connection that this can sometimes be related to not having been shown secure attachment, whether it's from parents or other people around you.
And not having made sense of it yet.
And not made sense of it yet either. Because because
that's
you can have those, you can have those experiences you mentioned, and it's not about having some sort of perfect upbringing because nobody has. It's about having made sense of it. So for
that's
people
who
have not had it and not made sense of it, what are just examples of patterns and behaviors that you see that develop?
Yeah, I think we can think about it in terms of relationships. So, you know, the two types of attachment we started with, talking about the avoidant and the preoccupied, what we see in relationships is that someone sort of avoids intimacy. They avoid looking at their own emotions. They might not even read their own body cues very well. And their partners or their friends might experience a lot of sort of emotional isolation or distance from them. They definitely have like the Simon and Garfunkel, I am a rock, I am an island, I don't need other people, the past isn't important, emotions aren't important, relationships aren't that important. So you might see an avoidance. Yeah, you might see an avoidance of that kind of stuff. On the other hand, kind of the other side of that coin, which is also an insecure style of attachment, is the preoccupied, where you're preoccupied with the past and you're preoccupied with emotions and you're preoccupied with relationships. And you might have a lot of anxiety and ambivalence of like, I really want people to show up for me. I really want to be able to trust people, but I don't know if I can trust them. I mean, are they really going to be there for me? So then they ask for more in relationships like, hey, I haven't, you know, had a lot of great success. So like, are you going to be there for me? And the people are like, sure, I'm going to be there for you. But then they have a hard time having their needs met in relationships. Their needs
are
too much.
Sometimes.
Yeah. And they also, they tend to be extra needy. So they kind of cling on to people. And then people are like, wow, you're kind of needy and intense. So they pull away. And then it becomes this self-reinforcing loop where the person's like, see, I knew people weren't trustworthy. I knew I should be anxious about whether or not I could trust this person. So just like the baby that can't be soothed, this person often has a hard time having their needs met in relationships. So what's interesting is if you couple those two together, one that avoids and one that's very needy in terms of emotion, which is always an interesting combo. So you have an avoidance of emotion and connection. You have a preoccupation with emotion and connection and really high need. And there's often tends to be a lot of shame spiral that goes with that one as well, like feeling like they're defective and people keep abandoning them and those kinds of things. And then in the disorganized attachment, it's more of like a fear response. Like when they're in distress, they don't know what to do. And they basically have a hard time problem solving. When they're in distress, they can kind of collapse into this more victim state, not really knowing how to solve problems, not having a strategy for how to move forward when there comes to adversity. So a lot of fear, a lot of triggering around
that. So for anybody who's listening to this and is like, wow, I can identify as being that. I can identify, you know, my friends have shared or I've had a past partner share that, or I can recognize that I'm a very clingy or I'm very avoidant or any of these other manifestations of behavior. And let's say they have or don't have kids. what is the beginning stage for them? You know, most of the writing is about how parents can show up better for their kids, but what's the beginning stages for them to begin to give them and make sense of what they feel that they went through?
So the most important feature as part of this reflection is to come up with and to get to a place where we call it a coherent narrative, where you're not running from the past and emotions, but you're not completely flooded and tangled up by them, but you're free. And this is also what we call secure attachment in adulthood, is called free and autonomous, where you're free to reflect on the past. You're free to look at emotions and to really look at how they impacted you without running from them or without getting completely lost and taken over by them. I would say that, and of course, in the Power of Showing Up book, at the end of each of these 4S chapters, we have a series of questions for reflection to ask ourselves. So even if you're not a parent, there's some really great questions for self-reflection there. You know, going to therapy and working with a therapist who understands attachment, who's kind of an attachment based, which would be a lot of therapists. Most therapists know at least something about this. But couples who struggle with this, EFT, emotion focused therapy, is an attachment based approach. And there are people who are trained in that. But really beginning to either walk through that process with a therapist or start reading about it, asking some of those questions, maybe journaling, starting to go back and reflect upon what your relationships were like and what was there for you and what wasn't there for you. You know, Dan has this beautiful analogy, which is that if a dog bites you, your first instinct is to yank your hand back, but that kind of shreds the tissue and it's hard for it to heal well. But if a dog bites you, you're supposed to actually reach your hand in just a little bit further, and the dog will gag and release its grip. And then you just have puncture wounds, which actually heal pretty nicely. And so Dan's analogy or story is that we have to have the courage to reach into the throat of our own histories, our own stories, and maybe even our own traumas, so that it can release its grip on us and we can begin to heal.
Sometimes people have this fear of, like, I don't want to bring that up. It's going to bring up all the past.
Why get into that hornet's nest?
Right.
Yeah.
And it's always there. You think always just because you're not thinking about it, your subconscious mind, it's not baked in, because it's not just in the mind, it's in the body.
It absolutely is. And we act out of that implicit memory, procedural memory, without even knowing we're doing that. And that's what's different about, you know, our explicit memory. We know we're remembering. The way implicit memory works is that it's not tagged as a feeling of knowing. So it actually totally impacts our perceptions, our behaviors, our emotions, our beliefs, and we don't even know that it's coming from the past. So this is why it's so important. And as parents, you know, I've had times as a parent where I've acted in a certain way and I'm like, that was crazy. Why did I make such a big deal about that? And it might be because I'm exhausted and I haven't gone to the bathroom by myself for 4 days, or, you know, those kinds of things. And that those are reasons we might not respond in ways we'd like to. But if we have a recurring theme that comes up with our kids, say every time our kid rejects us, like, I don't want you, I want dad, which is very developmentally typical for kids to prefer one parent over another from week to week. But somehow that makes me turn into a crazy person and I start yelling and I get mad at my kid. And I notice that theme coming up. There's probably something in my past around feeling rejected or being left out or not being included that I need to shine the light and go, what's that about for me? So I think when we find ourselves in any of our relationships acting in ways that don't quite make sense to us, it's an invitation. It's an invitation to say, wonder what that's about for me, or what gets evoked there for me. And it may or may not be tied to a specific memory or a specific kind of thing, but to even just get to a place where you go, that's a hot button issue for me. And I'm going to be aware of it so that the next time it comes, I can notice it so that I can choose how to respond to it.
Because when you choose how to respond, that puts you in a place of freedom.
Yeah.
And when you're free, you're just not walking around with all this baggage and feeling like the world is happening to you.
Absolutely.
You're a little bit more in control of how you decide to show up. So I want to go back to a question that I asked you earlier. So that was for people who are sort of noticing these patterns and might have identified with some of the things that you were sharing. For parents, and the question that I was asking earlier, which is, how can we set up our lives and circumstances around us to have the best support to pursue these things? How can we recreate the village for any parent that's listening and finds that it's difficult to practice these things on their own and is looking for support? Like, what are the tips that you have for individuals that are out there?
It's super important, I think, to have our kids have secure attachment with multiple people. Like, I feel like my kids are securely attached to me and their dad, and they've got multiple grandparents that are part of their lives, and they have secure attachment to them. And they've got all of these relationships that have reinforced in their brain, people show up for you if you need anything. What's so important for us as parents is we need people who show up for us. We need to feel the four S's, whether or not that's a partner, or our own parents, or our best friends, or our neighbors, or other parents at our kids' school. We need to have people in our lives that help us feel safe and seen and soothed. And we know that when we're at our wit's end, when something goes wrong, we have people who show up for us. You know, I had I mentioned to you, my boys are 19, 16, and 13. And last year, one of my boys has chronic medical issues, but he was having kind of a medical crisis. And then my other son, who was away at college, had a medical crisis as well. And I had to fly to Texas, and I was with him, and my husband was with our other sons. And we were really in distress at that time. Our kids had such big needs that we could not handle on our own. And we called upon our community. You know, grandparents came in, friends came in, people picked our kids up from school, people were helping take care of our dog. You know, we had people who showed up for us. So I think part of it is intentionally creating a community of like-minded people who will show up for you. And if, you know, it can be really isolating as a parent. When I had my first baby and I was a stay-at-home mom, and I was like, we had just moved here, and I was like, I don't know anyone, and it can be so isolating. And I think, you know, my husband actually found my first friend. He met her at Target, and she lived down the street from us, and our babies were the same age, and she was actually a rocket scientist who was staying home, so she was, like, really interesting. But I think find classes or groups or just at the playground, even if you're an introvert, like, force yourself to start conversations. Most everyone around us also feels isolated, and parenting is grueling, exhausting, amazing, messy, fantastic, all of that mixed together. And when you start showing up for someone else, they will often start showing up for you. So if you don't feel like you have people in your lives who show up for you, start showing up for other people, and then it becomes this reciprocal thing. So definitely create your community and find people. And, you know, oftentimes people will say, like, I really want to provide the four S's for my kids. I really want them to feel securely attached. And my husband does not do that for me. Like, I'm totally alone in this. And, you know, great if you guys can figure that out. You go to couples therapy, maybe he can start reflecting on his attachment, but he may not want to do that. Find other people, other friends in life who will help you feel those four S's. Because if we don't have it, we cannot give it. And to really do this work of helping our kids, you know, really tuning into them in the moment and meeting their needs, not perfectly. By the way, some of the research shows that if parents are predictably showing up for their kids in these ways, about 30 to 35% of the time, their kids can have secure attachment with them. So there's a lot of grace and a lot of room to be distracted and messed up and all of those things.
So just to make sure I understood that clearly, it's not about being like every moment. It's like that foundation of being good enough and really making it a priority, enough reps that are there, and that setting the foundation.
Yeah, you know, I was doing a talk on this a couple of weeks ago at a school, and when we got to the end, and I said, okay, so when do you do the four S's? And the next bullet point that came up was all the time, and then the bullet point that came after that is you can't do it all the time. You just can't. It's impossible. I mean, if you think about being in a relationship with another adult, you mess up all the time in a relationship. And with kids, they make it really hard to be really nice sometimes. You know, they really push all your buttons, and we all can get so exhausted and so at our end.
And this is still probably one of the first times in history that we're doing it primarily
without
by ourselves. Without help.
Yeah.
I remember just the other day I asked my mom, I had my girlfriend on speakerphone, and we were just talking about, like, hey mom, like, how are you raised? And like, when you were a new mother, like, how did the kind of community, my family was born in Kenya. I was born in Kenya. And we had this like big house there that a lot of families were all in. And when my mom and dad got married, they were in that house there, and his like had a brother and sister there. And I think my dad's parents were there. And my mom was like, I really couldn't even, when I got pregnant, first of all, there was so many things that just everybody around you just didn't let you do.
Yeah.
You have to rest. You have to do this. You have to do that. Like,
she
people tell,
for.
She was cared for.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing. Then the baby comes. And for, you know, I think she said even for the first like couple months, like she didn't make any food. Yeah. That was being done.
Yeah.
Because the next time then she's going to do it for somebody else. Yeah. And these other components. And then when the kids are there and she needs a break, or if her and my dad had like a date night, somebody's going to step in. Right. It's sort of built in into that. Now, there's a lot of challenges with living in a big household with other people. You know, maybe she didn't have the freedom to go explore some of the stuff that she wanted to, or she had to do things a certain way, or couldn't make certain foods. There's always these trade-offs in our modern lifestyle, right? And I think most people wouldn't want to trade away what they have right now. But that doesn't mean that we don't have to recreate it, or that we shouldn't recreate some version of that village that works for us today.
And I think, you know, less and less families attend churches and synagogues. I mean, that used to be a built-in kind of community, and less families do that. You know, it's great if that's your community. But if you don't have a community, I think you can create one. And I think one of the ways to do that is by sort of rituals or sort of regular ways of doing things. You know, when my kids were little, we just sort of had this tradition in the summers. Every Friday night, we showed up at a particular park at 5 o'clock, and we invited everyone we knew who had kids, and people brought their own dinner, so no one had to take care of, you know, some big kind of thing. And families would show up, you know, sometime in the evening, and the kids would run around, and the parents would get to connect and be like, oh my gosh, I have to tell you what happened. My kid's teacher called me this week, you know. And so we there's those times for parents to kind of debrief and connect. The kids get to debrief. There's, you know, a couple of moms and dads are playing pickle with the kids over here. And, you know, and so we knew every Friday night we were showing up at that park, and our community, we just invited people and they started coming and we became friends with them. And so we may have to take steps to create those kinds of communities.
Because it's
but
not
we
baked
need
in
it.
The way that it
it's
was
not.
Before. Yeah.
It's not.
But it's such an important part of the success that's there. Tina, this has been an incredible conversation. There's still so much more that we could get into. But I think this leaves people in a fantastic place, you know, from having read, didn't get to finish the entire book yet, but I read a lot of big chunks on it to make sure that I got the themes and the ideas. And there's so many incredible concepts that are in there that are really the tools and the techniques to show, not just for parents, but for people at any stage, for any relationship that they have, coworkers, friendships, other stuff, of how important these, how important that 4S process is and how it will radically transform the relationships in their life. So I want to congratulate you guys for another incredible book. My sister's favorite book is The Yes Brain.
The one that just came out before that.
And she has The Refrigerator. Yep, I haven't read that
book. The Refrigerator Sheet.
She has The Refrigerator Sheet.
We do that for all of our books. So you can just, you know, make a copy of it and it'll remind you of the main concepts of the book. So you can like put it on your steering wheel, put it on your mirror so you can remember.
Tell me a little about the Center for Connection and what you guys do there. And do you also, if there are people that are looking for a therapist and they're adults, do you guys work with adults as well over there?
Yeah, we sure do. So the Center for Connection is based in Pasadena, California. And it's something I started about 4 years ago as a mental health professional myself. I was seeing kids and their parents, and I was noticing that, you know, like they were having all these big behaviors. And as a trained mental health person, I could say, okay, well, this meets this diagnostic criteria. But I actually don't care that much about the diagnostic criteria. I was like, this kid's nervous system is in hyperarousal all the time. Even in a safe circumstance, his anxiety is out of control. What's that about? Why is his nervous system activating this threat response? And I really wanted to truly peel the layers back, because I think what we do a lot of times in medicine and in mental health both is that we try to just deal with symptoms, and we're not peeling the layers back far enough to find out what's causing the symptoms. And, you know, obviously if you're congested all the time and you have allergies or you have pneumonia, you know, the treatment's going to be really different. So I think why I started the Center for Connection is because I felt really limited with just a mental health training background. I wanted some other professionals who could help me chase the why far enough. So I have occupational therapists and educational therapists, neuropsychologists, speech and language pathology, and mental health across the whole lifespan.
And is it only in person, or do you guys do like Skype appointments? Mm-hmm.
There are therapists who do that, who do teletherapy, and all of them are trained in this attachment lens. And so we have people who only work with adults and couples, and then we have people who are, you know, work with kids and adolescents, and who do family work as well. But, you know, really, if you go onto Psychology Today or some other sort of therapy search tool, there is something on there about attachment or emotion-focused therapy or something along those lines. If you just type in, like, the city that you're you're in therapy and type in the word attachment, you may kind of, that might be a good way to kind of find who knows about that work.
For sure. And I will definitely say, having, you know, recommended different therapists that are out there and finding the right fit, it's a little bit of a dance. If you gotta, like, don't be afraid to, you know,
try a few out.
Everybody's different.
The fit is what matters more than anything, regardless of the modality. There's a lot of research. Regardless of what approach the therapist takes, it's the fit between the therapist and the client that is the best predictor for the outcomes of therapy. And, you know, this is actually really interesting, because what therapy essentially is an attachment relationship. And the therapist provides the feelings of safe, seen, soothed, and secure, so that it actually, the person starts having repeated experiences of someone showing up for them, which can then rewire their brain. They can look at their own history and create a coherent narrative, and then they're free to start providing those kinds of experiences in their other relationships. So it's sort of a mirroring of that parent-child process in our adulthood.
Amazing. We'll put the link in the bio for the Center for Connection. And if our listeners want to learn more about you, are you on social media?
I am. You can just go to my website, tinabryson.com, or on Facebook and Instagram, it's Tina Payne Bryson, PayneBryson.
I love it. Well, congratulations. The power of showing up, how parental presence shapes who our kids become and how their brains get wired. Such a fascinating conversation. Thank you for coming on the Broken Brain Podcast and educating our listeners.
Thanks for having me.